of unlawful use of a weapon and tampering with evidence. They will appear in court again October 28. The McCloskeys have blamed the leftist Democrats in St. Louis for their plight and have become folk heroes among some conservatives. They have received support from President Trump, and they spoke on video during the opening night of the Republican National Convention.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Archives, followed by Senior Notes at 8.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 71 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. This is a true crime episode. Later this hour, we'll bring you the story, The Usual Suspect. Stunning new evidence in the case of Carrie Max Cook casts serious doubt on his 1978 murder conviction and points emphatically at another man. But first, the conclusion of The Killer Next Door. Through the wall of our duplex, Richard and Nancy Lyon sounded like a happy couple. Then she turned up dead, and he was accused of poisoning her. Here's the conclusion to that article.
I had hoped Guthrie would show me that his client didn't kill Nancy. He had pledged as much in an unusual press conference 9 months earlier, which he called after University Park police named Richard as a suspect. Then Guthrie declared Richard most innocent and promised that if the case went to trial, it would be a real Perry Mason whodunit. I was hoping it would be, I suppose, for the same reasons I had continually denied Richard's guilt. It wasn't just my belief in his right to a fair trial. I also didn't want to admit that I had put my faith in a man who had coldly killed his wife. What I saw instead was the state's carefully laid out case, which implicated Richard at every turn. In testimony from Nancy's father, her doctor, Detective Ortega, and others, the state fashioned a picture out of her suspicions of Richard. Richard's apparent lies to the police, the autopsy report, the health pills packed with barium carbonate, and the paper trail of chemical purchases that ended with a December arsenic delivery. I was stunned, too, by the testimony of a man who, in January 1991, repainted and cleaned the apartment Richard had lived in while he was separated from Nancy. Among Richard's belongings, the man saw several empty clear gelatin capsules, the same as those containing the two tainted health pills. There was also the subsequent tenant at the apartment who testified that while cleaning the back of a bathroom cabinet, she found a prescription bottle in Nancy's name. Along with the pills inside were two antibiotic capsules laced with sodium nitrofuricinide, another poisonous chemical that Richard had bought from General Labs in 1990. Money, not just his romantic liaison with Ein, appeared to be the motive. Nancy was worth about $1.2 million, including $500,000 from her life insurance policy. 4 months before her death, she had removed Richard as beneficiary, naming her children instead. The children's nanny, Lynn Peasewoods, had signed as witness to the change. According to Lynn's testimony, it seemed as if Richard didn't know about the switch even after Nancy's death. The defense's attempts to counter Lynn's testimony looked suspicious. Guthrie introduced a typewritten note addressed to Richard, dated November 1, 1990, and signed Nancy, which mentioned the beneficiary change. But Lynn testified that Nancy didn't know how to type, and even took pride in that fact. Through his cross-examination of other state witnesses, Guthrie deluged the jury with a muddle of doubts. He suggested other suspects, Bill Jr., for instance, or Nancy's former boss at Crow Development, David Bagwell, who had been sued by the Crow companies for misappropriating $720,000. Nancy had been a potential witness against Bagwell and had received a death threat relating to the case in 1989. Guthrie had also hinted at suicide, but that scenario seemed unlikely when the state introduced a 9-page letter from Nancy to Richard, written 4 months before her death, in powerful, intelligent, eloquent prose. When read aloud, it was as if Nancy's voice had suddenly come into the courtroom to state her own case. "My nature has always been to be so optimistic, so positive, so charged up about my life. And over this last year, in losing what I valued most in my life, I have let myself be so consumed by fear, unhappiness, heartache, and misery that I have compromised my values and principles and lost sight of myself, my needs, and my dreams. I can see clearly that the children and I need and deserve so much more. They need a loving, consistent parent who is there for them day and night. They need stability and predictability and a promise that no matter what, they will be defended, protected, and safe. Every moment, every day, I no longer have any desire to hold you to your marriage commitment. Not only are you free to go, but I need to demand that you go before even more damage is done to the children and to me." I watched Richard cry as the letter was read. I will never believe, as some suggested, that his tears were just a ploy to win the jury's sentiments. But I could feel my focus changing. I no longer wondered if he had killed her. I wondered instead what twisted passion had carried him through the months of premeditation, through the hours of her retching at home, through the days of her decline and death. I cannot pretend to know what happened between Richard and Nancy, but I believed then, as now, that Richard loved her once, as deeply as he must have grown to hate her. On the day the state rested its case, Richard came over to me in the courtroom. He asked about Sean and told me about Anna's funny antics. As we talked, I had trouble looking into his eyes. I could feel the Dillards' friends staring at us. When he asked how I thought the trial had gone, I shrugged and said nothing. "Just wait," he told me. "All the facts will come out." When he took the stand 2 days later, Richard never denied ordering the arsenic. He said he bought the poison to kill fire ants at the duplex and at a job site. Although his testimony drew snickers of disbelief that his supposedly all-organic company would sanction arsenic as a fire ant control, I knew the duplex had an ant problem. In late summer 1990, it had gotten so bad that I asked Nancy about it. "Richard's working on something," she told me. As Richard described it, he planned to bore into the mounds and then spray poison. Nancy had worked with him on the scheme, he said. In fact, it was Nancy who suggested buying arsenic in the first place. Richard's testimony also put him 250 miles from Nancy during the hours on January 8th, when she would have gotten the fatal dose of arsenic. Airline tickets, restaurant receipts, and eyewitnesses all confirmed that he had been in Houston since early that day, and had arrived home around 6, about the time Nancy began to feel sick. He portrayed his wife as a vulnerable, sickly woman. All through the fall of 1990, he said, Nancy had called him often, complaining of illness. Her calls always drew him back to the complex, he said, to check on the children or to help her. As proof, he offered writings, he said, were Nancy's. Pages of notes, when Richard said he found in a file box 3 months before the trial. Nancy had been in counseling nearly all of her final year. I knew she wrote often about her therapy. Once, I had seen the walls of her bedroom covered with sheets of paper. 2 pages offered by the defense particularly played into suggestions of suicide or other suspects. One described how Bill Jr. had incestuously violated Nancy for years, how her family had denied it, and how Richard had tried to help her. Tried to save me, the note said, with his sincere heart and his unending patience with my hang-ups about sex. On the bottom of another page was written, fears of Bill and what his desires are, sex, sick sex incest issues with me, my girls. The defense had hired a handwriting expert who had said the writing was Nancy's. Later, they would put on the stand James Grigson, the psychiatrist known as Dr. Death, for his controversial death penalty testimony. Solely on the basis of the notes, Grigson described Nancy as deeply troubled, calculating, controlling, and manipulative. He suggested that she had made herself sick with poisons to lure Richard back into the marriage. By itself, the theory seemed preposterous. Arsenic poisoning is a painful, prolonged, and agonizing way to kill oneself. What's more, Nancy hadn't acted one bit suicidal in the weeks before her death. She made her usual Christmas gifts and planned trips for the coming year. Her daughters seemed far too important to her. And why would she have cried out for help in the hospital if she had known all the while what was killing her? Then Guthrie produced the receipt. It was dated September 6, 1990, from a company called Chemical Engineering in Dallas. It listed purchases of 4 chemicals, barium carbonate, lead nitrate, cyanogen bromide, and arsenic trioxide. It was signed Nancy Lyon, with her driver's license number beneath her name. As Richard stood before the jury, pointing to a blow-up of the receipt, the change in the courtroom was physical. He testified that he had found it stashed in the same files with her private writings. For the first time during the trial, Rosemary leaned forward and tried to catch my eye. "Can you believe it?" she mouthed. It was hard to know what to believe, particularly when the president of Chemical Engineering, Charles Couch, testified later that his firm specialized in recycling old carpeting. But Couch, a large man with the cocksure manner, also acknowledged he was known in the business as someone who could devise chemical formulas. In September 1990, he testified, a woman had called him to discuss fire ant poison. According to Couch, the woman never identified herself, but she told him that she and her husband were trying to inject poison into the mounds with a long drill. When Couch offered to look up a formula for her at the Southern Methodist University Library, the woman asked if he could drop the notation by her house, which, she said, was right next to campus, as our duplex was. Couch testified that he did look up a formula which matched the items on the receipt. But he never dropped it off. Instead, the woman apparently came to his plant the next day to get it. He testified that he never saw her. He was on the phone in the back office at the time. Through one of his employees, he passed the formula, which he had jotted on notepaper with his company's logo. But Couch called the receipt a forgery. It had no invoice number. It was typed, while all his are handwritten. And, oddly, it had a notation to call Keith or Charles on the bottom, names of contractors who transport huge quantities of chemicals for the company. Couch said he remembered inadvertently jotting their names on the bottom of the paper, with the formula right before the woman came to pick it up. Yet, even if Richard had forged the receipt, it was hard to explain the call Couch had gotten. Equally puzzling were the results of additional forensic tests on Nancy's hair, which the medical examiner's office had requested in May. Bundles of the hair had been sent to Vincent Gwynn, a chemist at University of Maryland, who uses a technique called neutron activation analysis to detect various chemicals in hair. Before analyzing the hair, Gwynn had sliced it into tiny segments, each representing roughly 2 weeks' growth. The results showed that in addition to the lethal dose in early January, Nancy probably had ingested arsenic at least two other times before that. A sizable dose sometime between mid-December and New Year's Eve, and a much smaller one in mid-November. Both were before Richard could have received the arsenic from General Labs. There were theories to explain the evidence. Richard might have gotten arsenic elsewhere. Maybe Nancy's hair grew faster than normal. Maybe shellfish or hair coloring caused the small November dose. Yet, the autopsy showed Nancy's fingernails had at least five times more arsenic than her toenails, a result that suggested she might have handled the chemical, either by touching poisoned food or the arsenic itself. 2 days before the end of the trial, it seemed Guthrie had achieved reasonable doubt. That day, Sean visited me at the courthouse for lunch, and Richard chatted easily with him in the hallway. As I watched, it seemed that more harm would come from a conviction than from an acquittal. I lost all faith less than 2 hours later. On rebuttal, the state produced Hartford R. Kittle, a retired document examiner from the FBI. Unlike the defense's handwriting analyst, Kittle compared all writings and evidence not just with Nancy's known samples, but also with Richard's. I had always marveled at how similar Richard and Nancy's handwriting was. In graduate school, I later learned, they had actually worked to make their writing look alike for design projects, giving it the same angular N's, the same long loops below their G's and their Y's. But Kittle pointed out their differences. Richard's eyes were a straight line down. Nancy's were framed by little cross lines. Richard's F's sometimes had a backward loop. Nancy's never did. Nancy's S's were always serpentine. Richard's were sometimes scripted. And then I saw how, in the most powerful of Nancy's personal writings, in the pen scratches that spelled out, "Bill violated me for years," "Six, sex," and "Richard with his sincere heart." In nearly every word that damned Nancy, there were Richard's handwriting peculiarities. To my eyes, the call wasn't even close. Kittle also questioned the authenticity of the signature on the insurance note and couldn't identify the one on the receipt from chemical engineering. The jury returned its verdict less than 3 hours later. As the courtroom doors opened, I saw an ashen Richard looking back at the crowd filing in. When the foreman read, "Guilty," Richard's eyes widened. Then he stared straight ahead, hung his head, and sighed. "I can't believe this has happened," he told Guthrie minutes later as they sat in a holding cell. "I'm innocent." Outside, amid a flurry of television cameras, the Dillards were whisked away. In the emptiness that followed, journalists milled the halls, looking for someone who would comment on the case. I walked toward the elevators and left. Soon I was driving up Central Expressway in a pouring rain. As I had done so often in the years before, I turned off at Mockingbird and zigzagged past SMU to the duplex. The shutters were drawn. The Christmas lights were hanging in the same loose way as the year before, when I had taken them down as Nancy lay dying. Sitting there in my car, it seemed absurd that after all these months, my doubt about who killed Nancy should have fallen apart based on the shape of an I, an F, and an S. But that was all it took. Mere markings of a pen had become, for me, the desperate imprints of a very convincing liar. On New Year's Day, I went to see Richard in jail. He wasn't expecting me. I didn't quite know how to alert him that I was coming, so I simply showed up. Richard entered on the other side of the bulletproof glass, dressed in white jail overalls. An orange ID band encircled his wrist. He looked pale but lively. He sat down easily and picked up the phone. He looked as even-tempered and pleasant as I remembered him. There was no desperation in his voice or face. "How are you doing?" I asked. "Not great," he said, "but we're working on getting a new trial now." His talk quickly moved into a litany of reasons why he should have been acquitted, especially with what the forensic evidence showed. "You tell me how I could have given her those prior exposures," he said. "You tell me, and then I can sit in a jail cell and think about it. But you can't tell me. That's reasonable doubt." I was blunt with him. The handwriting analysis had hurt him. So did his apparent lies to the police. And it simply didn't make sense that Nancy would beg for help in the hospital if she had killed herself. "I don't understand it either," he said. "I lived with her, and I don't understand it. All I know is that she bought arsenic. That receipt is real. Why would I forge that stuff?" As he talked, he looked me straight in the eye, and I found myself searching his pale green irises for some hint of the truth. All I saw was calm, logical analysis. He had an answer for every question. The thought crossed my mind at one point that Richard is either delusional, thoroughly evil, or innocent. And at that moment, I really could not tell which it was. "You know me," he said. "You know I would never do anything to hurt the girls. I would never have taken away their mother. Why would I kill her? I would have walked away from the marriage." I was hoping my visit would give me some closure to the matter of my neighbor's death. It did not. What was I expecting, after all? That Richard would suddenly break down, confess, set forth the story with ambiguity, allow me to walk away that night satisfied that at least I knew the whole wretched truth? Instead, as the guard came to get him, Richard left me with this. "I can only pray that the truth will come out someday," he said, "because it didn't at the trial." I cannot say Richard Lyon killed his wife beyond all possible doubt. Like the jury, I believe he is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but my knowledge will always be in fragments, like the glimpses I had during the years I lived under his roof, like the pieces of evidence that became the court record. Or, as I thought driving back from the jail that night, like the way I saw his eyes shift downward only twice during my visit with him. The first time was when I asked about his daughters. The second time was when I suggested that maybe Nancy got her poison in the Zovirax capsules she had been taking at the time.
The culture. The usual suspect. Stunning new evidence in the case of Carrie Max Cook casts serious doubt on his 1978 murder conviction and points emphatically at another man. By Michael Hall. Published June 2016. On the morning of June 10, 1977, Linda Jo Edwards was found brutally murdered in her Tyler apartment. It was a horrifying scene. The 22-year-old, naked from the waist down, had been stabbed more than 20 times in her face, neck, chest, and pubic areas. Her mouth had been slit, and parts of her body seemed to be missing. A piece of her lower lip, sections of her vaginal wall. It was one of the most heinous crimes in Smith County history. There were no signs of forced entry, a signal to investigators that someone Edwards knew probably committed the crime. Her roommate, Paula Rudolph, told police that a man had been in Edwards' room late that night, and though she didn't get a good look at him, she assumed it was Edwards' boyfriend, 44-year-old James Mayfield. The man she glimpsed had medium-length silver hair and white shorts. Mayfield had medium-length silver hair and, being a tennis buff, was known to wear white shorts much of the time. Mayfield, aware that he would be a suspect, came to the police station later that day to tell his story. Yes, the father of three had been having an affair with Edwards. He had been the head librarian at Texas Eastern University and had hired her. They had been seeing each other for a year and a half, but he swore it had ended 3 weeks before. More important, he had an alibi for the previous evening. He said he had been home with his wife, Elfrida, and his daughter, Luella. The police questioned Luella and cleared Mayfield. By then, they had embraced an entirely different idea of who would have committed such a brutal, twisted crime. 3 days after the murder, a psychologist named Jerry Landrum, who had previously worked with the DA and lived in Edwards' apartment complex, looked at the crime scene photos and talked with officers about the murder. Then he offered them a psychological profile of the killer. It was a man, he said, between 18 and 30, probably gay or bisexual, maybe high on drugs, and definitely introverted. He was, Landrum testified in front of a grand jury, a sexually inadequate male with pathological hostility who mutilated the body in specific places, in hatred and anguish. Police began interviewing everyone at the apartment complex, and eventually a resident told officers about a young man who had been staying with him who seemed to match the description. His name was Carrie Max Cook, and he had spent time behind bars for stealing cars. He had also spent time at Rusk State Hospital, a facility for individuals with mental illness, where he had been evaluated as having an inadequate personality, immaturity, and impulsiveness. Cook was young, long-haired, purposeless, and bisexual, considered by many in 1977 to be a sexual perversion. He had also left town a few days after the murder. When his fingerprints matched those on the outside of Edwards' patio door, he was found, and in early August, arrested and charged with murder. Thus began the first steps of what would become one of the most harrowing journeys through the criminal justice system in modern American history. Cook, who always proclaimed his innocence, was tried 3 times for Edwards' murder. In each trial, one of the main witnesses against him was Rudolph, who testified that she had seen him in Edwards' room that night. Cook was convicted twice. The third trial ended in a hung jury and sentenced to death. Twice, his death sentences were overturned, with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals pointing to egregious prosecutorial and police misconduct. In the 20 years Cook spent on death row, he tried to kill himself two times. Cook was eventually freed on bond in 1997, pending an unprecedented fourth capital murder trial. But days before it would begin, prosecutors came to him with a plea bargain. Plead no contest and walk free. He could maintain his innocence while the state could maintain its conviction. However, while he would be free, he would not be exonerated. Terrified of going back to death row, he took the deal. In the aftermath, he became a criminal justice cause celebrity. He wrote Chasing Justice, a book about his experience. He was the subject of a popular play and movie called The Exonerated. Now he gives speeches, pals around with anti-death penalty celebrities, and travels the world giving inspirational talks to teenagers. In Dublin, he's a hero. In Tyler, he's still a convicted killer. But that could all change after Monday, June 6th. In a Smith County courtroom, Cook's attorneys from the Innocence Project and the Innocence Project of Texas will present shocking new evidence that finally gives him a chance to, if not prove his innocence, at least show that someone else was a much more likely person to have killed Linda Jo Edwards. Someone with the means, motive, and opportunity to kill her. Someone who modern DNA tests prove left his semen on her panties. Someone who recently admitted having sex with Edwards on the day before she died. Someone who felt she had ruined his life. Someone who was seen in her room not long before she was murdered. Someone who we now know positively was not Carrie Max Cook. Someone like James Mayfield. Everyone who gets sent to the Texas death row has a story, and each convict is unique in its own way. But no one has a story like Carrie Max Cook, which I wrote about in September 2015. From 1978 to 1994, prosecutors took Cook to court three times, even though they didn't have much evidence. Fingerprints on a patio door, a jailhouse informant who said that Cook had told him he killed her, the recollections of a gay man who said that on the night of the murder, he and Cook had had sex and watched a movie that involved a cat torture scene. Prosecutors came up with the bizarre but effective theory that Cook, whom they said was a latent homosexual, was aroused by the torture scene and then left the apartment and raped and killed Edwards, cutting off body parts, which he then stuffed in a stocking of hers that had gone missing. But all of the evidence used against Cook proved to be problematic or downright fraudulent. It turned out that three different witnesses had testified to a grand jury that Cook told them he had met Edwards 3 days before the murder and had gone to her apartment, where they made out on the couch, which explained the fingerprints. Prosecutors didn't tell the defense about the witnesses. The jailhouse snitch confessed that he had lied because he had been offered a reduced sentence for his own murder conviction. The man who testified he had had sex with Cook had previously told a grand jury there was no sex, and that Cook had ignored the movie in the first place. And the missing stocking that was supposed to be full of souvenir body parts was found in 1992, rolled up in a pants leg of Edward's jeans by a juror who had asked to look closely at the trial exhibits, 15 years after the murder. Cook's first conviction in 1978 was overturned on a technicality. The second trial in 1992 ended in a mistrial. The third trial in 1994 led to a second guilty verdict and death sentence. But in 1996, the Court of Criminal Appeals overturned it too, thundering that prosecutorial and police conduct has tainted this entire matter from the outset. A concurring opinion said, "The state's misconduct in this case does not consist of an isolated incident or the doing of a police officer, but consists of the deliberate misconduct by members of the bar representing the state over a 14-year period, from the initial discovery proceedings in 1977 through the first trial in 1978, and continuing with the concealment of the misconduct until 1992. It looked like Cook was finally on his way to exoneration and he was released on bond in 1997. But Smith County wasn't finished and set about trying him for a record fourth time. As the February 1999 trial date approached, prosecutors made him an offer: plead guilty in exchange for 20 years, which he had already served, and the charges would be dropped. Cook refused. He was innocent, he said. Then on February 4th, a DPS analyst examining Edwards' underwear found a previously unseen semen stain. The state moved to run modern DNA testing on the stain, as well as a hair found on her buttock. According to reporter David Hanners of the Dallas Morning News, assistant DA David Dobbs told him that the semen could have only been left by the killer. On the morning of jury selection, the DA shocked Cook with a final offer: plead no contest and the case would be dismissed. Such a plea had never been allowed in a Texas death penalty case before, but with it, Cook could maintain his innocence, even though he wouldn't be legally exonerated, while the state could keep its conviction. Cook's advisors, suspicious that prosecutors were panicking because they knew his DNA would not be found in the sample, urged him to go to trial. Cook, though, terrified of going before a Smith County jury again and returning to death row, took the plea. He should have waited. The DNA results came back 2 months later, and as Cook had always insisted, it wasn't him. In fact, the semen came from Mayfield. Cook was ecstatic, but the Smith County DA's office now said that they just confirmed what everyone knew: Edwards and Mayfield had a sexual relationship. Though Dobbs had told Hanners the DNA was essentially the smoking gun, now he told another reporter it's irrelevant. Cook has been convicted of the murder. And indeed he had. Cook tried to move on with his life and had a terrible time of it. He was free, but still had a murder conviction on his record. I couldn't get a job, couldn't sign a lease, he said later. We've had to move 5 times because people would find out about me. One woman threatened to put up posters in the neighborhood saying convicted murderer lives here. He couldn't vote, own a gun, or run for office. In 2009, Cook befriended Mark McPeak, a civil lawyer who offered to help him. 3 years later, McPeak, working with Dallas lawyer and Innocence Project of Texas member Gary Udishin, filed for DNA testing on another crime scene evidence, including a bloody knife. The lawyers also moved to recuse the judge who would rule on the testing. That judge was Jack Skeen, who had prosecuted Cook twice. Judge John Overd okayed the testing and the recusal, sending all further matters to be decided by fellow Smith County District Judge Christy Kennedy. Next, Udashin contacted the Innocence Project, which has used DNA testing to exonerate more than 300 people nationwide. 15 items from the crime scene, including Edwards' stained bra, her jeans, cigarette butts, and blood on the knife, were sent to Cellmark Forensics Lab near Dallas. They were tested over the next 2.5 years. The final results came in March. The results corroborated the 1999 findings. None of Cook's DNA was found on anything at the crime scene. More elaborate DNA testing on the underwear, though, got an even stronger profile of Mayfield. That DNA evidence, tested in 2014, 20 years after Cook's last trial and 15 after his no-contest plea, has never been introduced into a court. And so, last year, Cook's lawyers filed a writ of habeas corpus, using it to claim Cook is innocent. They are also basing a claim on Texas's recently passed junk science statute, which allows petitioners to use new forensic science to successfully attack a conviction. If a petitioner can show that, with the new scientific evidence, it's more likely than not that a jury wouldn't have convicted him, he could be awarded a new trial. It's obvious, Cook's lawyers said, that if the jury had seen that the semen belonged to Edwards' ex-boyfriend, Cook would have been found not guilty. The lawyers also alleged that the prosecutors knew when they offered the no-contest plea that Mayfield's DNA profile would be in the semen, not Cook's, either because Mayfield or his attorney told them, or they had a preliminary report from the lab. The state fought back against Cook's charges when it filed a response in November. Cook is not in prison, the state said, and so a district court in Smith County has no jurisdiction. Besides, he's made a good life out of his status and has pursued a career as an author, lecturer, lobbyist, entertainer, and an international celebrity. He also waited too long to file his writ, 16 years, and a bunch of witnesses are dead or missing. Plus, the state argued, Cook knowingly took that plea bargain in 1999, so he has to live with it. And he was on record saying he knew the results wouldn't point to him anyway. As for the DNA evidence, the state asserted that it isn't new. The 2014 results were essentially the same as the results from 1999, and also that the evidence didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. Mayfield and Edwards had a sexual relationship. It is impossible to determine scientifically when Mayfield's DNA was placed on the victim's underwear. In addition, the brief asserted that there was other evidence of Cook's guilt and pointed to how Rudolph had pointed to Cook in court as the man she saw in Edwards' room that night. Earlier this year, the dramatic case got even more drama. In January, Udashin filed a motion for the Smith County DA's office to provide any exculpatory evidence it hadn't provided before. DA Matt Bingham, who was elected in 2004 and never worked on the Cook case, offered up the entire case file, 50 boxes. This spring, Udashin and his partner, Bruce Anton, drove to Tyler three times and made copies of files. They found several pieces of evidence they didn't know about, and one was explosive. It was a police report filed in 1991 by Tyler PD detective Eric Liptak. Rudolph, Liptak wrote, told police she thought the man in the apartment was Mayfield. But Liptak went on. Ms. Rudolph did later state that the man she saw was Mr. Mayfield, but that was after extensive questioning by Mr. Thompson, the lead prosecutor in the case. In other words, according to the report, the lead prosecutor knew that Rudolph originally identified Mayfield as the man in the apartment, but prosecutors never gave Liptak's report to the defense, as they are required to do. They never corrected Rudolph on the stand when she said she had never identified Mayfield, nor did they correct her when she identified Cook at the trial as the man she saw in Edwards' room. All roads led to Mayfield, Udashin and Anton thought, a man who had never been properly investigated back in 1977. Even in the early days of the investigation, when Mayfield's status as the boyfriend of the victim should have triggered a more intense investigative response, police had steered away from him. Perhaps it was because Mayfield's lawyer, Buck Files, had refused the request for polygraphs of both Mayfield and his daughter. And then, just 6 days after the murder, cut off all further questioning of the Mayfields. As Detective Eddie Clark later wrote in a police report, Files didn't want anyone else talking to his clients. By then, police were looking for a pathologically hostile bisexual killer. Udashin and Anton were certain Mayfield had lied about when he had last had sex with Edwards. The DNA told them that. But also that Mayfield, or Files, had somehow indicated to prosecutors in 1999 that the semen was his. This spring, the two badgered Bingham, who had never talked to Mayfield, and the district attorney made the lawyers a highly unusual proposition. Let's all go see what he has to say. Udashin and Anton jumped at the chance. Bingham reached out to Files, Mayfield's attorney, about doing an interview. Bingham would offer immunity from prosecution for anything Mayfield said in the interview. He just had to tell what really happened back in 1977. Mayfield agreed. The interview was held April 5th at Mayfield's home in Houston. Udashin and Bingham asked questions, and Mayfield, whose wife sat in on the interview, gave answers. He had told some of this before, back in 1977 and 1992, how he had promised Edwards he would divorce his wife, and even filed for divorce, and how he and the younger woman had even moved in together at the Embarcadero Apartments on May 13th, and how his daughter came to his office and made a scene, threatening to kill Edwards if her dad didn't end the affair. How after 4 days, he realized he had made a big mistake and returned home, wanting to reconcile with his wife. How upset Edwards had been when he broke it off. How the next day, she had tried to commit suicide, taking sleeping pills, and how he had found her unconscious and taken her to the hospital. How afterward he asked Rudolph, who also worked for him at the library, to let Edwards stay at her apartment. Mayfield said that everybody on campus knew about the suicide attempt, hospitalization, and scandalous affair, which led his boss to ask for his resignation. With his career in shambles, he was determined to save his marriage and even went to a counselor who told him to stay away from Edwards. But he couldn't. And then Mayfield revealed that he had indeed lied for 39 years about one of the biggest elements of the case. His admission was made casually, as if it were just one more memory from an indelible afternoon. "The day before she was murdered was my birthday, June the 8th, Mayfield said. "And I had gone to Linda's apartment, and we had had sex, and then she gave me a bunch of presents. She gave him a tennis outfit, some shirts and socks, and a watercolor she had painted." Cook's attorneys were delighted, knowing they were one step closer to corroborating what a prosecutor himself admitted in the past. The semen could only have been left by the killer. Mayfield also elaborated on what happened the next day, Edwards last, how she had called him and seen him multiple times. First, she phoned him in the morning and said she wanted to come over to his office and water his plants. Around noon, he was sitting with some other faculty members when she approached and asked if they could go somewhere to talk. She suggested Dairy Queen. Mayfield didn't want to go, but he did. And at the DQ, she told him she wanted to move to a new apartment complex. So later, at 5, the two drove in two cars to go see what she had in mind. Afterward, Mayfield drove home, and between 6:30 and 7, Edwards showed up at his house, in front of his wife, and asked him to help with her car. "My car's not really running right," Mayfield remembered her saying. Within hours, she would be dead. When Udashin was done with his questions, he felt he had laid out the strongest case yet that Mayfield had both opportunity and motive to kill Edwards. He was the last person seen with her. His DNA was found in her underwear, and he had lost almost everything. Job, career, home, the Mayfields had decided to move to Houston because of his affair. Bingham, who declined to be interviewed, would have none of it, and when it was his turn, he asked Mayfield if he had told previous prosecutors that the semen was his. "No," Mayfield replied. Bingham asked straight out if Mayfield had killed Edwards. Again, the reply was no. They were friends, he said, and he was her only support. Bingham asked, "Is there anything about you having intercourse with her that day, June 8th, that would have caused a problem with your wife, with you moving to Houston, or with the university that would have ever led you to harm her?" Mayfield replied, "Good Lord, no." Jim McCloskey isn't so sure about that. In fact, McCloskey, who helps run the New Jersey nonprofit Centurion Ministries, has been waiting for 26 years to hear Mayfield admit he had sex with Edwards on his birthday, and it makes him even more certain that Mayfield killed her. McCloskey took an interest in Cook's case in 1990. He and his group had been working to exonerate wrongly convicted inmates since 1983. Centurion's work had, in 1990, helped exonerate Clarence Brandley, an inmate on the Texas death row. And when Cook wrote McCloskey asking for help, McCloskey began investigating. What he found amazed him. No one had ever seriously investigated Mayfield. McCloskey interviewed more than 50 of the Mayfields' friends, neighbors, relatives, and colleagues, and took affidavits from some of them. None, McCloskey wrote, had been interviewed one-on-one by Tyler police, a sign, he said, of just how shabby the investigation was. McCloskey put together a report, pointedly titled, Why Centurion Ministries Believes James Mayfield Killed Linda Jo Edwards. Remarkably, he wrote, these people who knew Mayfield at different times and through different means of association, almost to a person, believe that Mayfield not only had the capacity to kill, but could very well have killed Linda Jo Edwards. Mayfield's distinctive personality trait, McCloskey found, was a fiery temper, likened to a volcano by one witness, and an electrical capacitor by another. Mayfield, one witness said, was a guy who would shake with red-hot and glassy rage. McCloskey interviewed 9 women who had worked with Mayfield and wrote, 8 described Mayfield as a vindictive, abusive, evil and sick personality, whose mood swings were unpredictable and frequent. One of the women said, we at the library were afraid after the murder because we suspected Mayfield of killing Linda. As for Mayfield's motive, McCloskey found plenty of evidence to back up his theory that Edwards was obsessed with Mayfield and possibly stalking him. His secretary said that Edwards totally worshipped Mayfield until the very end. There was nothing that she would not do for him. Another co-worker said that during the period after Mayfield returned to his wife, Edwards said out loud 2 or 3 times, I'm going to get him back, no matter what. McCloskey also got an affidavit from Frederick Mears, a psychology professor at UT Tyler, formerly Texas Eastern, who said that he had found a book in the library called The Sexual Criminal, a Psychoanalytical Study, which contained graphic photos of victims of crime scenes. Mears stated that Mayfield had ordered the book sometime in 1976, and another professor confirmed that Mears had complained to him about Mayfield doing so. Mayfield denied ordering it. The injuries in several of the photos, McCloskey said, mirrored the injuries Edwards suffered. He wondered if Mayfield had used it as a textbook for murder. McCloskey didn't keep his research a secret. In fact, it was the backbone of Cook's defense in both his 1992 and 1994 trials, where his lawyers asserted that Mayfield was the actual killer. Today, in light of the recent interview and the police report confirming Mayfield's presence in Edwards' apartment, McCloskey is more certain than ever that Mayfield was the killer. Linda Jo still loved Mayfield, he says. She knew she could seduce him and bring him back through their sexual addiction. So she invites him to the apartment on June 8th, his 44th birthday, and showers him with gifts, and they have sex. The next day, she visits him 4 times. In his mind, she won't go away. His narcissism blames her for destroying everything he holds dear. Family, career, his entire way of life. Yet he knows he can't resist her if she is nearby. In the interview, he concedes she might follow him to Houston. If she does, the turmoil and turbulence in his life will never end. So he snaps and ends it by destroying that which he believes destroyed him. All of that is just a theory, of course, but it seems to be more coherent than the one offered by the state back in 1978, one that has been factually dismantled ever since. The one saying that Cook, after having gay sex on his couch, was so aroused watching a cat torture scene in a Kris Kristofferson movie on the TV that he left and went to Edwards' apartment and butchered her in a state of frenzy. It's exceedingly difficult to win on a habeas writ, especially in a death case. But Cook, helped by the powerful Innocence Project, seems to have his best shot at vindication, and maybe a finding of actual innocence. Partly this is because of the overwhelming new and uncovered evidence that Cook didn't kill Edwards, and that maybe Mayfield did. The judge doesn't have to find that Cook's lawyers proved Mayfield killed Edwards. All he has to do is find that, with the new evidence, no jury would have convicted Cook. Another reason Cook stands a chance is that the judge in the case is not from Smith County or Tyler, a small town with very tight legal community, many of the members of which have connections to this troubling case. Consider the county's four district court judges, one of whom is Jack Skeen, who prosecuted Cook in 1992 and 1994. Another judge is Carol Clark, who is married to the prosecutor in Cook's first trial, A.D. Clark III. The judge who was originally set to adjudicate Cook's habeas writ was Christy Kennedy, whose late husband Richard was an assistant D.A. under Skeen. Cook's lawyers asked Kennedy to recuse herself, and she did, in September. The new judge, Jack Carter from Texarkana, retired in 2014 from the 6th District Court of Appeals, which handled appeals from 19 different Northeast Texas counties, but not Smith. After the hearing, he will make a recommendation to the CCA on whether to turn down the writ or grant it, and if so, whether to recommend Cook should get a new trial or to be found innocent. Cook, who lives in Toms River, New Jersey, with his wife and son, will be in attendance, as will several of the men who prosecuted him and investigated his case. Cook hasn't seen any of them since he was freed in 1997. Mayfield will be there too, with his wife and daughter. McCloskey will make the trip as well. They'll testify and tell their stories, which should take the better part of a week. If there's any justice in this world, the hearing will conclude on Friday, June 10th, which is the 39th anniversary of the murder of Linda Jo Edwards. Now, going to Wikipedia to read an addendum to this story. This is from Carrie Max Cook's entry on Wikipedia. It gives his biography and also gives us information about the earlier trials that we just read. Here's the last sentence in that Wikipedia entry. On June 6, 2016, prosecutors agreed to drop the charges against Carrie Max Cook. This was motivated in part by James Mayfield's admission that he had lied about not having sex with the victim for weeks.
Hello, I'm Ernie Manous. Coming up on Interviews, our conversation with the man who suffered through this horrifying nightmare and lived to tell the tale, Carrie Max Cook. I'm reading in your book, and it says, you're telling people, other inmates, I'm innocent. And we, of course, all assume everyone on death row says they're innocent. As you listened to everyone else say they were innocent, did that deflate you somewhat? Did you feel like, oh my, everybody here is saying the same thing I am? You know you're innocent, but you got to assume the rest of them aren't all innocent.
It was a snake pit. I'll tell you why. Not only does everyone say they're innocent, because what? I want to volunteer and die? I mean, what are they going to say? I mean, they're legally, that's the only legal protection they have. I mean, if they admit, make any admission, then they're certain to die. In their mind, they're thinking, I got a chance if they think I'm innocent. I mean, what else can you do? But the pressure was, yes, as you said, correctly said, everyone says they're innocent. And then here you are saying you're innocent, and they think you're guilty too. They think you're just saying it too. But when you start getting publicity that you could be innocent, they don't believe you, and they're not getting any attention, it's a little dangerous.
It is just an amazing story, and I am so pleased that you were able to get through it. I mean, I don't know how someone does that. But thank you so much for sharing your story
with
us.
Thank you, Arnie. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Carrie Max Cook.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Recording Library of West Texas Radio is bringing you the League of Women Voters of Texas Nonpartisan Voters Guide for 2020. This 2.5-hour program can be heard Saturday at 1 p.m., Sunday at 9 a.m., Monday at 6 a.m., Tuesday at 6 p.m., and Wednesday at 3 a.m. The Voter's Guide is funded and published by the League of Women Voters of Texas. The League never supports or opposes political candidates or political parties.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 69 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Please note that in order to protect the safety of volunteers and staff and recording services around the country at this time, some productions have been reduced or eliminated. The show that follows substitutes for the program regularly scheduled for this time.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and welcome to the ballroom and thank you for joining me. Go grab your pencil and paper. Just come to think of it, do people still use pencils and paper? But nevertheless, let's get ready because later in the show, I'm going to ask you to judge a battle of the bands, a battle royale from the late 1930s. But to officially get the Make-Believe Ballroom underway, how about some good old-fashioned big band era boogie? Beat Me Daddy, 8 to the Bar is a song that was written in 1940 by Don Ray, Huey Prince, and Ray McKinley. Well, Ray McKinley was credited, but it's what he said, not what he wrote, that placed his name on the sheet music. Let me explain. The title uses 1940s hipster slang coined by Don Ray's friend, Ray McKinley. McKinley was a drummer and lead singer in the Jimmy Dorsey Band for many years in the 1930s. McKinley kicked off certain up-tempo songs by asking Dorsey's pianist, Freddie Slack, who was nicknamed Daddy, to give him a boogie beat or 8 to the Bar. For that reason, Ray gave a partial songwriting credit to McKinley. Cool story. Even cooler is the Will Bradley and his orchestra version of Beat Me Daddy, 8 to the Bar, recorded on the Columbia label May the 21st, 1940, and featuring the aforementioned Ray McKinley on the drums and Freddie Slack on the keyboard. ¶¶
Texas. There's a guy who plays the best piano by far. He can play piano in a way you like it, but the kind he plays the best is A to the bar. When he jams, it's a ball. He's the daddy of them all. The people gather round when he gets on the stand. Then when he plays, he gets a hand. The rhythm he plays puts the cats in a trance. Nobody there bothers to dance. And when he jams with the bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, head to the bar. A plink, a plank, a plink, plank, plink, plank, plunking on the keys. A rip, a rap, a rip, rap, ripping out with ease. And when he jams with a bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, head to the bar.
Freddie Slack was a charter member of the Will Bradley Orchestra, and he went on to form his own very successful band in 1942, where he signed with Capitol Records. Daddy Slack recorded three songs at his